This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Tonight, a horror 911 call. A husband finds his wife, his young wife, Brooke Hanlon, stabbed dead. Quote, there's blood everywhere. And as we go to air tonight, no arrest. Good evening. I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. I want to thank you for being with us.
I just found my wife. I don't know what's going on. CPR. I need CPR. Just hit start. I need an ambulance. Oh my God. There's a laceration in her throat. Oh. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. I just found my wife. I don't know what's going on. CPR. I need CPR. Just hit start.
Okay. She's not breathing or conscious.
Oh my God. There's a laceration in.
Okay, sir, bear with me one moment.
No,
we're getting help there. Just stay on the line and need some more information, okay?
No. I don't know if there's blood. I need you here. I need you here immediately.
Sir,
she is
bleeding and she's not conscious, is that correct?
No.
Okay.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God.
All right, sir.
I'm not moving. No, please,
okay.
Don't do anything. No.
All right, listen carefully, and I'll tell you how to do chest compression. Sir, place the heel of your hand on the breastbone in the center of the chest, right between the nipples.
There's a cut. That's where there's a cut.
I'm sorry, what was that, sir?
There's blood everywhere.
What happened to a new mom, Brooke? Her baby girl is turning 1 year old this month. Why is the baby in the care of her parents? What happened? Why is there no arrest? Joining me, an all-star panel to make sense of what we are learning tonight. Straight out to Dana Kennedy joining us, senior investigative reporter, Daily Mail. She broke the story and was the first to identify the victim as Brooke Hanlon. I understand, Dana, that Brooke was a therapist. My first question was, did she work with violent offenders that could have sought her out and murdered her when her husband was conveniently not home? Did they watch her home? But then, upon investigation, I learned she counseled teens and children and families. But hold on. That's putting the cart before the horse. Tell me what was found on the scene. What happened, Dana Kennedy?
Well, first of all, this is one of the most unusual murders I've ever covered in that I was the one. This is not me blowing my own horn. It's just the weirdness of the story. Morris County prosecutors had this victim, murdered woman. They called it a homicide, but they didn't ID her for 3 weeks. They didn't ID her to 2 days after my article. So that was the most bizarre part of it, Nancy. And there's still a ton of questions to be answered about what you just asked about the crime scene. We just heard the 911 call, which is unusual in that the husband first seemed to be asking for CPR as if she was simply unconscious, then spoke of a, quote, laceration, then said there was blood everywhere, which is bizarre because how could blood everywhere after he came across her? That doesn't make sense. And to your question about her patients, now, obviously, I don't know who every last one of them was. She did work with children and teens. There was something on her bio that said she worked with adults as well. But she mainly did telehealth appointments, Nancy, and she hadn't been back in Chester Township, which is where she grew up. She just moved back there 2 years ago, and she had a baby. So this was not a lot of time, Nancy, to have had, you know, a long-term patient that might have turned on her. And finally, if it was a patient, Nancy, it's very strange the patient would stop Brooke and choose a moment in time when her husband apparently left the house on a Saturday to go to a hardware store. He had a job. So if this person were going to stop her and kill her, why not do that when the husband was at work 5 days a week? Doesn't add up.
Okay, another question. Dana Kennedy joining us, investigative reporter, senior investigative reporter, Daily Mail. You stated this happened on a Saturday. Was the baby at home?
We think the baby was, but I don't have any confirmation. I did knock on the door of her father when I went out there the first time. And he indicated the child was staying there, which to me is the most probable outcome of this. It would make a lot of sense. And I also happen to know that Brooke and her husband stayed with her parents prior to getting their house set. Her father was, I'm not sure if he's retired yet, he's about 66. He was a very powerful general counsel for big drug companies in New Jersey. So they have a huge, real mansion.
Which leads me to my next point, and I'm going to go to esteemed investigator John Bueller, who shot to fame during the Scott Peterson investigation and took the stand during that prosecution, which resulted in two murder convictions. Bueller, thank you for being with us. My first question
is, good to be with you. Yeah.
The baby's home. I'm not hearing anything about a forced entry. I'm not hearing anything about a sex attack on the mom. I'm not hearing anything about items missing, one of the cars being gone, nothing. And you just heard Dana Kennedy, the senior investigative reporter with Daily Mail. She knows what she's talking about. She did say that this was a ritzy area. What ritzy area isn't blanketed in video cams? I mean, it's like being in a Vegas casino. You can't scratch your head without somebody catching you and saying, hey, that's rude. So is there not video surveillance? Where was the hardware store? Yeah, I always have a problem, Bueller, which I discussed with you at the time Lacey Peterson went missing. Translation, was murdered by her husband, Scott Peterson. When the real killer is just an expert at timing. You know, the minute Scott Peterson leaves, boop, she's killed in the park and nobody sees anything. This husband is gone to the hardware store. How far away is it? A couple of miles? And in that sliver of time, she's murdered. Interesting, correct?
Yeah, it really is. And Dana, you know, gives a good outline on that stuff. I can't disagree with anything that she says. It's all right down the line on that. How convenient that he goes to the hardware store. We're at a disadvantage because we're not letting much out on this case. As you know, they're keeping it pretty close inside the investigation, which is wise for them. But of course, it's a little bit disadvantage for us. But the big thing for me when I'm listening to that 911 call, it just sounds staged. It sounds overacted. Overdramatic. I've got a little bit of a problem with an adult his age not knowing that CPR is not going to work.
Put him up. Repeat. You mean the fact that the husband's screaming like a fifth grade girl?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, to not even know that CPR is not going to be useful when you got a chest wound that's got blood all over the place and he's screaming for all that stuff. It just sounds overacted to me and a little bit overdramatic. Now, that's not to say he did it, but of course, everybody's suspicion is going to go to him first because he's the closest to the victim. So we all know that we're going to look at him closest. But the mere fact that her sister was the one who went on and was talking about Brooke and the husband's nowhere to be found on these interviews, that's a little strange. You would think he would be out there in front leading the challenge to get the killer and find him wherever he is.
Oh, my stars. Bueller, are you kidding? Do you remember Sharon Rocha? She took to the airwaves. She and Ron Gransky, her husband, who had been like a father to Lacey, were everywhere begging. And remember, they stood by Peterson for the longest time until those photos came back with his hand on Amber Fry's rear end and that red dress and everything started falling apart. But they stood by him. They were everywhere. Peterson was nowhere. And you're right. Again, I'm not saying the husband's responsible. I don't know that. But I am saying, where the H are you? Man, get out there. You want to find the killer? Then get the H out there and start helping and start looking. Do something. I mean, I would be lying on the courthouse steps screaming, who did this thing to my family member, my beloved? Well, where is he? Nowhere. Apparently, he hyperventilated during the incident, but I think there's a lot to be gleaned from the 911 call. You know, when I would present these to a jury, I would play them in full and then break them down by portion, usually chronologically, not always, but portions that were probative, that meant something to me. Okay, I want you to hear the 911 call, another part of it. It goes on quite extensively.
I got this. You got it, Brooke. Come on, baby. Come on.
Keep going, sir. One, two, three,
four. Oh, my God.
There's
a huge cut. What the f***?
And where's there a big, a large cut, sir?
One on our breast. There's one right below our breast.
Okay. Just keep going, sir. Okay. Keep going, sir. We have responders pulling up. Just keep going until they take over.
I need
two,
him. I
three,
need
four. One, there, two, three, four. Just keep going. They're right outside. Just keep going until they take over, okay?
Yes. Come here.
Keep going until they take over, sir. Keep going until they take over.
Please, now.
Are those the responders, sir?
Yes.
Okay, you can speak with them, sir, okay?
I found her.
I have listened to this over and over and over, line by line, and I know somebody else has done the same thing. Her name is Patty Wood, body language behavior expert, president of Communication Dynamics, Inc., author of SNAP, Making the Most of First Impressions, Body Language, and Charisma. You can find her at pattywood.net. Okay, Patty, I'm just a trial lawyer. You're the language and behavior expert, but he led with, I just found her. Methinks thou doth protest too much. That's from Shakespeare. And also, who in their right mind, what normal person says laceration?
Let's talk about the language there. In rhetorical analysis, the words mean everything. It's interesting he chose I found her instead of first speaking about her injuries or her being hurt. Also, lacerations, and later he talks about I need you here immediately. Those are multi-syllable words. Typically, when you're in shock, you're in your limbic brain. There's no language there. It's very primitive, and you don't use neocortex multi-syllable words when you're speaking. So though his sound, the paralanguage of his voice, sounds very shocked, very surprised, very overwhelmed, he's choosing words that don't go along with truly being in that emotional state, which I find interesting. Also, something else that's really interesting at the beginning of this call in terms of the word choice. There's typically, when a family member, a loved one is injured or missing, you use their name over and over again. You want to bring them close to you. Instead, he talks about his wife. Now, his wife is right there in the room, and it's not until he's doing the CPR that he even says her name. So it's interesting to me that he's saying, my wife is, instead of calling out her name or using her name to bring her close.
You know, another issue following on what Patty Wood has just told us to John Buehler, I have never once in all the homicide cases I've investigated, prosecuted, pled out, or covered, I don't think I've ever heard on a 911 call a relative, much less a husband, say, there's a large laceration. Who says that other than one of us who in the business or a medical examiner? Who says laceration?
Yeah, his choice of words on that is unusual. But, you know, another thing that kind of struck me is asking for instructions on how to do CPR. I mean, really, who doesn't know how to do CPR in this day and age? And even if you don't do the count exactly correct, you know where to place your hands. You know how to do the chest compressions. You know how to do ventilation if you're going to do that. And for him to conjure that up and say that, it doesn't mean he did it. But it's just very, very suspicious that he would use that he would talk that way. And to me, just that whole hysterical nature is overplayed.
Straight out to preeminent trial lawyer, defense attorney Randy Kessler. Emory Law School professor, that's not shabby, past chairman of the ABA Family Law Section. I guess you had to do some politicking to get that. How many bodies did you climb over? Whatever. Author of Divorce, Protect Yourself, Your Kids, and Your Future. And you can find Kessler at ksfamilylaw.com. Okay, Kessler, did I get it all out for you? I think I did.
Hey,
Kessler, Did you hear what Bueller said? Did you hear what Patty Wood said? I can't wait to hear what you're going to say.
Yeah, look, you know, everyone wants to convict, but this is not even circumstantial evidence. This is like circumstantial evidence. So if someone reacted the wrong way, someone used the word laceration.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Excuse me. That's not a word. None of that is a word. You sound like you're stuttering.
I'm saying it's circumstantial.
Okay, stop.
Right. It's
you know what? I don't have time for you. I do not have time for you.
That's fine, Nancy.
Why don't you just start over and stick with the law and the facts and don't make up any words? Okay, now.
So it's not even circumstantial evidence. It's not even close to circumstantial evidence. So someone reacted the way that you don't like, or that people don't like the way he reacted to seeing his wife stabbed and bloody and bleeding to death on the floor. I mean, that's not how we convict people. That's not why we convict people. That's the conclusion we all seem to be jumping to. Yes, I agree. You know what? He's the only person we know about because the police haven't revealed anything else. So we all want closure, and we'd like to find some evidence to prove that it's him. But there's no evidence except that he was there. And if that's enough to put somebody away for the rest of their life, then we got the wrong system. He's innocent until proven guilty. They've got to do a lot more than just say he used the wrong words. He used multisyllabic words. He didn't react the right way. He didn't know how to use CPR. There are a lot of people in this world that don't know how to use CPR. We can't convict him on that. You know, he's got to be given the presumption of innocence. And that's how our system of justice is based. He's innocent. You got to prove him guilty. None of this proves him guilty. Does it create suspicion? Sure. Does it create a desire to find somebody and he's the only one we have to point the finger at, so everyone's pointing the finger at him? Sure, but it's pretty telling that the police haven't pointed the finger at him yet and charged him or even called him a person of interest after this much time. If they had more than that, by now you'd think they'd be saying, you know what, let's make sure he's under arrest, he's got a bond, he doesn't get away. You know, if he was guilty, he'd be in Mexico, right? He'd be somewhere far, far away. So far, they need a lot more to convict him. He ain't guilty until you can prove it. And so far, I don't see proof that he's done it.
Kessler, you're like $1 million Stradivarius. I don't even have to tune you up. You just go. But you play the same tune every time. He's not charged with anything. You don't have to hit me with presumption of innocence. Okay, neither I nor anyone watching our program, they're all legal eagles. They don't need you to tell them about the presumption of innocence. There's no charges yet. And I don't want to convict him. I have no interest in convicting him. I have an interest in catching the killer and either putting them in jail for the rest of their life or giving them the death penalty. This is a young mother, one child. Her baby is turning 1 year old this month without the mother. When they go back to look at family photos, they're going to have a picture of her funeral. Mommy's memorial service. I'm not letting this go. I don't care if it's him or some intruder, some unknown intruder is the real killer. I want them. But first, I'm looking at him because he's a husband. And typically, we know statistically that law enforcement looks at the family first because overwhelmingly they did do it. And I'm not saying he did do it, but I'll tell you what I am saying. I want the video of him in that hardware store. I want his digital footprint. I want to find out when he left home. Did he leave his phone at home? Did he turn off his phone during the crime like Brian Koberger, like Barry Morphew, presumed innocent? So long story short, there's a lot of evidence to be amassed. But let me throw this to you. Query, why is the baby with her parents? Why isn't the baby with daddy?
Okay, again, those are all good emotional reasons why we want to catch the killer. And even if they didn't have a new baby, you'd want to catch the killer. But why is the baby now with somebody else? There could be 1,000 reasons, Nancy Grace. There could be reasons like this guy's got, he's having a mental breakdown, which a lot of us would have if this happened to our spouse. He could not stabilize and be consistent for the child. He wants to remove the child from the
system. I don't know about that. Put him up.
There are 100 reasons. Maybe he's got
a lot of us would have a mental breakdown. I'm thinking back on all of the murder victims that I represented in court and their families. They did not have mental breakdowns. They were distraught. They could barely put one foot in front of the other, but they did not have a mental breakdown. Would you like to reconsider what you just said?
No, I would not, because there are 1,000 reasons why family members could have a child instead of the natural parent. I'm not there. I don't know why the other parents, the other people have custody of this child for now, but I can think of a thousand reasons. I'm a family lawyer. There are a lot of times when it just makes more sense to remove a child from the person immediately connected to the situation, the person who's under questioning by the police, the person who's going through a lot of stress. Just because the child is living with somewhere else right now at an infant age doesn't mean that he's guilty of murder. Yes, it's a question. It's an issue. It's certainly, again, we're not getting to the stage of he gets charged or convicted because his child is living with someone else primarily right now. Look, older parents, grandparents, relatives might be the best place for this child right now to remove them from the immediacy of this situation. I don't think that's enough to say, okay, he must have committed murder. Is it a bad fact? Sure.
Okay, nobody is saying that the husband committed murder. Nobody's okay. Naming him as a suspect. Good. Or a POI, not person of interest. No, nobody's saying that. I'm saying these are the facts. That is a 911 call. And I also find it really interesting, back to John Buehler, that the first thing that comes out of his mouth is, I just found her. Well, it's not about you, man. It's about her. I just walked in and, oh, there she is. Why is that the first thing he says? I just found her. Look, hey, I just got here. I don't like that. I'm not sure what it means. I'm going to have to go to Patty Wood to figure that out. But it means something.
Yeah, you know, volunteering things like that is a way for him to build, you know, his story and to try and take the focus off of him. I can see that. And, you know, nobody's saying the guy did it. Nobody said he's, you know, convicted or anything like that. He might be very suspicious in the court of public opinion, but his demeanor and the words he chooses and things like that do make it suspicious. Of course, the cops aren't telling us everything. He might be their number one suspect, but they're not going to release that until they're ready. Kind of like the same thing we did with Peter. He was a suspect for a long time before the handcuffs clicked on him.
To Dana Kennedy joining us, senior investigative reporter, Daily Mail, who has been on this from day one. In fact, she put it out there before cops would even give the victim's name, which I, too, Dana, find very unusual because typically they want it out there. So anybody that knows anything, like somebody say, here's a great, great example. You know, the Monique Tepe case where the ex-husband from 10 years ago, who is a well-respected medical doctor in another town, the family comes forward to the victim and goes, hey, this guy has been stalking her and threatening her for 10 years. Look at him. And sure enough, he's busted. He's looking at a murder trial. So why didn't they want to, law enforcement, put her name out there, put her face out there and say, look, do you know of anything, anybody that would have done this? I believe the husband is a construction worker, and we know that. My uncle is a construction worker, and we know that very often they have day laborers. Did one of them find out where he lived and come in and surprise her and kill her and run? That's kind of a far-fetched scenario, but it could happen. So it could have been anybody connected to him or her. She's a shrink. Is there a disturbed patient? Is that in her notes? Is that in her recordings after sessions? I would want to put that out there, but they did not do it. They wouldn't even release her name. You had to dig, you had to mine like a coal worker to get her name. Remember?
Well, there's so many strange things about the beginning of me covering this case, because when I went out there, I spoke to the neighbors on either side of the Hamlin, and neither one of them had been approached by police. Immediately after the murder, a cop came by one of the neighbors and said, do you have a Ring camera? They didn't sort of end the story. I also, when I was out there the first time, went to the police station, and I went to talk to the father of Brooke, and he came to the door, clearly heartbroken, but was strangely, and listen, I don't need to walk in his shoes. I can't blame him for this, but he was strangely cagey. I asked him point blank, do you know where your son-in-law is? And he said, no. Then he kind of tried to walk it back, and then I kept going further because he was willing to speak to me, and I said, you know, in these cases, normally, the first person they look at is the husband. Did your son-in-law do this? And he basically said, I don't know. But there was no charge around. And at this point, his daughter had been murdered in cold blood. 3 weeks had gone by. And you would have thought there'd be some charge around the son-in-law. And there wasn't. And even stranger, Nancy, is one day after I showed up in Chester, and of course the cop knew, the father knew, two detectives came out to speak to one of the neighbors that I was speaking to, and the next day another detective came out there. They never went to the other neighbor, and it seemed to me, and I don't know, it seemed a bit performative, because remember the Murdoch in South Carolina? How could we forget them? I was also down there a week after that murder happened. Went to Moselle, the place where Maggie and Paul Murdoch were murdered. It was wide open, like it hadn't been a crime scene. I called SLED, you know, the law agency in charge of this South Carolina, and said, why is this not a crime scene? Within about 2 hours, they shut it down. And within less than 48 hours, the Murdoch brothers went on, I think, Good Morning America, to sort of cry crocodile tears and talk about a reward and a tip line, none of which was taking place right after the murders happened. And it reminded me a little in that way, but that doesn't make any sense because unlike Alec Murdoch, who basically ran the whole county down there, this guy is not a powerful guy. He does not come from a powerful family.
Some of that from our friends at Fox News. I want to go to a special guest now just joining us. It's Jeff Gentry. He's joining us out of Fresno, California, forensic certified bloodstain pattern analyst. Let that sink in. Senior crime scene analyst, death investigator, former toxicology lab analyst, author of Forensic Science, Applications to Death and Crime Scene Investigations. And to find him, go to evidenceoverassumption.com. I like that, evidence over assumption, because Jeff Gentry, I don't care how our expensive Stradivarius, a.k.a. trial lawyer Randy Kessler, spins it out, blood spatter doesn't lie. It doesn't lie. Now, what would you, Jeff Gentry, be looking at? And what do you believe LE, law enforcement, is looking at tonight?
What I would be looking at as a blood pattern analyst in these cases is, first, I'm looking for specific blood patterns that are going to tell you what type of injuries were sustained. So you want to find the location where these injuries were sustained in the home. So I'd be looking for like impact patterns when somebody is plunging a knife into somebody. I'd be looking for cast-off patterns. And then what I would be looking at very specifically on this husband who allegedly did CPR on her is I'd be looking for evidence of blood patterns that would suggest that he was around this stabbing incident when it occurred. So I'd be looking for impact pattern blood stains on his clothing. I'd be looking for cast-off patterns on the back of his clothing that would indicate that he was the one swinging the knife around. I'd be looking for evidence of cleanup, because typically when husbands specifically murder their wives, they are going to make it look staged. They're going to make it look like somebody just randomly came into this remote home when they left for a couple of minutes at the store. They're going to stage it to where it appears that somebody else was involved. When 9 out of 10 times, it's going to point right back to them. So those are the type of blood patterns I'd be looking for. Somebody that is completely innocent, that just randomly stumbles upon their stabbed to death wife, which doesn't occur often, they're going to have transfer patterns on their hands, their clothing, evidence that they were trying to render aid. There'd be evidence that they were manipulating the person in an appropriate manner. They would not have impact spatter blood stains on them. They would not have cast off patterns on them. So those are the things that I'd be looking at specifically, and I'm sure that's what the police are looking at too, and they don't want to release names, they don't want to release specific information, because they want to see what this husband is going to say. They want to see what his behavior is going to be. What is he doing that would be different than a normal husband that actually did find their wife murdered? You know, if there is somebody else that was involved, the evidence will point to it, but we got to see how the investigation plays out.
And again, the husband in this case has not been named a POI. Person of interest. He has not been named a suspect, and I am not gunning for him. I'm gunning for the killer, whoever that may be, because there's a little girl out there who's having her first birthday without her mother, and when she goes back through the photo album, she's going to see photos of mommy's funeral, not photos of mommy holding her, taking her to school the first day, the whole shebang. That's over. That's never going to happen. Speaking of cleanups, back to John Buehler joining us, seasoned forensic investigator. Buehler, do you remember going in to Lacey Peterson's Covina address? And I remember looking in the home, and everything was completely immaculate. It was perfect. It was like a little dollhouse. Was there any evidence that there had been a cleanup after Lacey went missing? I know the laundry had been freshly done, but what did you find?
Well, actually, the laundry that was done there was Scott's laundry when he got back from fishing. He took wet towels and things like that that were in the washer that were getting prepared to be washed. He took those out and replaced them with his clothes.
Stop. Let me understand something. Before he started looking for his missing wife, he decided to do his own laundry.
Well, that and, you know, eating some pizza and drinking some milk and things like that. Yeah, he apparently he was under the impression, a false impression, obviously, because the evidence shows that he did it, but that maybe she was at the neighbor's or something like that. But then, of course, he quickly went into she's missing. He didn't ask if she was at the hospital. He didn't ask if she was at Amy's. He didn't ask if she was at Sharon's. He just, when he called Sharon, he said, Lacey's missing, drawing an instant conclusion, you know, to take him away from that. So, but getting back to the house, like you mentioned, yeah, it was like something out of Better Homes and Gardens or Florida Architecture or something like that down here. Everything was in place with a couple of exceptions. There was a mop bucket that was outside of the house that Scott claimed that she wasn't going to be able to move, and he had to move it for her before he left, even though she was supposedly mopping when he was leaving. And then there was a rug that was bunched up by the north end of the house by the door that leads out to the carport that was in a perfect position that would replicate if you were dragging a body of a pregnant wife dead through the house on the way out to the carport. So little things like that kind of showed it. There, you know, just like Jeff was saying, you know, you're in a scene like this, you're going to be looking for blood, but in a suffocation or a smothering with upper body strength and the ability to lean or, you know, kneel on somebody's shoulders while you take the life away from them, you're not going to have that kind of evidence. Yeah, I'd love cast off blood, high impact spatter. Everything that Jeff talks about is just, you know, interesting things to us because we dealt with it just like he did. He did a lot more than I did. When I looked at his bio, this guy is pretty much at the top of the pyramid when it comes to that stuff. But these are the things that we always would look for. And in Scott's case, the only thing that he had, as you remember, is that cut on the knuckle that he claimed he got from the door or something like that in his truck.
Jeff Gentry, jumping off what Bueller just said, if there had been a cleanup. Wait, hold on. Wait a minute, Gentry. I think I hear some strumming of the Stradivarius in the background. Kessler, is that you crying? Because if there's evidence of a cleanup, that means it's not a random intruder who goes in, murders someone, and then takes time to clean up the scene.
Yeah, who convicts somebody just based on that? That's not enough. Okay, yeah, it doesn't help. It doesn't look good. But, you know, these are little pieces here and there. You got to have, there's no eyewitness. There's no recording. There's no confession. You know, maybe he did it, maybe he didn't do it, but you got to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt before you start taking a chance of putting somebody away for life for something that they may or may not have done.
Is that what I asked you? Look, I don't want to be harsh with you, but you're non-responsive.
I asked you a question
about a crime scene cleanup indicating that it is not a random interloper. Would you agree with that? That's a yes, no, Kessler.
Yeah, you got a point. Okay, you get one point. Yes, it's a point. I agree. It's a point.
Okay.
I
don't think Let me move on to my next point as you describe probative evidence.
Okay.
If there had been a cleanup, it clearly suggests that it was someone not afraid to linger in the home. And I'd also want to know, was her body cold by the time EMTs got there? But someone not afraid to linger in the home. Think JonBenet Ramsey. Someone took the time to write not one, but two very extensive, in-depth, very colorful, very narrative ransom notes. And then after that, write two of them, a practice and a real one. Then leave them in the home and then go, oh, you know what? Forget it. I'm not going to do the whole ransom thing. I'm just going to kill her and leave her right here in the basement. That killer was not afraid of hanging out at the murder scene. They were in no fear of being caught.
Those are
so
different
what does
facts.
That tell you in this case if there had been a cleanup?
Nancy, not afraid to linger is different than cleaning up, Nancy. Just because you're not afraid to linger, maybe the danger is more that you'll be caught if you don't clean up. So maybe it's worth the risk to linger. If your fingerprints, if your evidence, if your personal items are in the home where the murder happened, then you might be afraid to linger, but you're more afraid to leave that stuff there. So whoever cleaned up and took out the proof or the evidence of who did it probably thought it was worth cleaning up more than it was worth getting out of there fast. So I don't think that's a point, Nancy. I disagree.
You know, you're really amazing. You are. No matter what I throw at you, you're just like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, that. That's the ticket. Okay, that's why you win so many cases. It's truly amazing. My hat is off to you. I'm a little bit embarrassed for you, since you obviously don't know to be embarrassed for yourself. But you're amazing on many levels. Yes, yes. To Jeff Gentry joining us, I want to jump off what Kessler just said. And I'm serious. Consummate trial lawyer, wins a ton of cases, represents all kind of high-profile celebrity clients. That said, and what Bueller said, Gentry, we don't know that there's a cleanup yet. But if there had been a cleanup, what would you look for? Let me guess. Drains? Faucets? What?
I'd look in the drains, of course, to see if there's hair, remaining blood stains, anything that somebody is throwing away. I'd look in trash cans. I would look to see if there was any evidence of bedding, sheets, towels being washed. I would look with Blue Star or Luminol around sinks. I would look for any weapon types to see if I could identify the weapon. I mean, that's one thing that we haven't really talked about yet in this case. Was a murder weapon even recovered? In a lot of cases, you are, yes, looking for solid forensic evidence. You're looking for bloodstains on knife. You're looking for knives or weapons. You're looking for DNA. You're looking for fingerprints. But if it's somebody that lives in the home already that has committed this crime, you're not always going to get that solid forensic link to a case because their DNA is already going to be present. Their fingerprints are already going to be present in the home. So you have to then rely on the accumulation of circumstantial evidence. You have to look at their digital fingerprint. You have to look at their timing. You have to look at their body language, things that they've said. So there's a lot of things.
You know, something I love about Luminol that you just brought up, Jeff Gentry, when you use Luminol, of course, you need semi or complete darkness to really see it. But if there's a cleanup, Luminol, of course, will highlight, it's like a black light poster, would highlight the iron in blood. And you can actually see where somebody has cleaned up, like with a rag, a wash rag, or even a mop. You can see the trail of mop or hand rag markings. It's very apparent. Then you've got the alternative light source method. But people believe that if you clean it with Comet or bleach, it's going to get rid of it. Not necessarily so. Not going to get rid of DNA. You need more of a muriatic acid to really destroy DNA. Do you agree with that? And how do you actually extricate the faucet to look in it? And if water has been run after blood or human tissue has been put in the faucet, if you run water, how do they find it?
The Blue Star or Luminol, it actually detects very dilute blood. So that it was designed for that purpose. Even hunters use it when they're tracking animals out in the woods. And so the suspects that are cleaning up crime scenes or attempting to clean up crime scenes, actually they're doing us a favor because they're creating more surface area for that Blue Star or Luminol to react with. And it reacts with the hemoglobin in blood. So like you mentioned, the iron compounds is what creates that glowing effect or that Blue Star reaction. And you can see it in dark. And in some cases, you can see it in daylight, too, if it's a strong enough reaction. But that's what we'd be looking for, is evidence of cleanup, that blood being diluted around sinks, on floors, anywhere that cleanup has occurred. And with the drains, you just simply take it apart. You just do it in a step-by-step fashion, and you're collecting hairs, fibers. Then you can also Blue Star the inside of the sink just to see if there has been any dilute blood in there. Sometimes bleaches or chemicals will have a reaction with the Blue Star, but typically it's very apparent when blood cleanup has occurred.
Right.
It's a very obvious reaction.
Look at the Rex Huerman case, Jeff Gentry and Rex Huerman. They tore down the whole house to take apart the bathroom and everything else. That said, another interesting point, Dana Kennedy, you said the dad, the victim's dad, was a big exec or lawyer with Big Pharma.
Yes.
And they've got 1,000 a $1,000 reward. It's almost as if they don't even think they need a reward.
Well, that's kind of what I think. As I've been saying throughout the whole, show, nothing adds up. And to someone else's point about the murder weapon, I doubt, of course, I don't know, because they are smart county prosecutors are so extremely tight-lipped, but I don't think they got the weapon because a neighbor told me that the police who were there at the house for 3 days at least and were parked outside overnight for at least 10 days were looking in her yard for something. So you have to assume that was a murder weapon. I too, if I had to guess, I would assume that they are probably looking at the husband. And as I said before, when the detectives went to talk to the neighbor, that was after I had been out there. Why wouldn't they have talked to the neighbors for 3 weeks? That makes absolutely no sense.
We wait as justice unfolds. And let me remind everyone, we are on the search for the killer, not a vigilante mob surrounding the husband's location with pitchforks and torches. That's not what we want. We want the truth. And we want to give the baby girl the truth. If you know or think you know anything about this case, please dial Morris County Sheriff's Crime Stoppers 973-267-2255. And we remember tonight, American hero Deputy Marshal Michael Hansen, U.S. DOJ, shot in the line of duty, leaving behind a grieving wife, Natalie, and two little children, Cole and Sadie. American hero Deputy Marshal Michael Hansen. Thank you to our guests, but especially to you for being with us. Nancy Grace signing off for tonight. I'll see you tomorrow night. And until then, good night, friend.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.